food. Oh, let's try that again. You got it? Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It looks like I was speaking into the wrong microphone, but now it's the right one. And thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. It's December 30th, 2014. Not much left of this year. Are you ready for 2015? I am. Do we have a choice? I guess. Not really. But 2015, it's going to be good, right? We're all looking for a better year. Although, depends on how you look at it. 2014 has had its ups and downs just like any time. I was just looking over the Responsible Eating and Living website and some of the things that we were doing over the last year. And I'm a bit of a workaholic, and yet I'm always judging myself and thinking I didn't do enough. I didn't get enough work done. And yet when you look back, even if you just look at the pictures from the year and you've seen all the things you've done, I'm really pleased what we've accomplished and what happened in 2014. And it reviewing it all made me really excited about what we're going to be doing for 2015. So stay tuned for that. So the holidays are almost over, and I hope you have survived so far. And you know that food is always that important element in holidays. It could be a good element. It could be a bad element. It can cause a lot of frustration and tension with family members who may not agree with what you want to eat. And we all tend to overindulge, even the ones who are particularly careful. I know that I did. And I always like to say I'm not a religious person, but I love holidays and I love food. So we did a little bit of Hanukkah. We did a little bit of Christmas. And Hanukkah consisted of lighting the menorah and singing some songs and making my favorite baked potato latkes recipe. I hope you've checked it out and hope you've checked out that video. I just love this recipe. And I just took the recipe yesterday and modified it. And instead of using potatoes, I used turnips, because I had a lot of turnips from my winter CSA. And I was never a turnip fan as a kid, but I'm really liking turnips today. And they made a wonderful turnip pancake. I haven't posted the recipe yet, but stay tuned. It should get up on the website soon. And then I really like the way we did Christmas this year. We just kind of did it in an intense way. It started maybe like 24 hours before Christmas Eve with some decorating and some cooking, and then we had a nice Christmas Day dinner, and then it was over and we cleaned up. Not too much music, not too much of anything. It was just really a lovely, lovely moment and some great food, like my favorite almond biscotti that I like to make for holidays. We have that recipe at Responsible Eating and Living. And we had this wonderful breakfast, which consisted of our no-egg French omelette souffle with kale and onions. It's a delicious kind of decadent breakfast when you're having a special event or a holiday. So you might check that out at Responsible Eating and Living. I just wanted to talk about food a little bit because it's all about food. So that was a happy moment about food. Now let's get to some more serious stuff about food, because I know that's what you want to hear, right? So I'm going to bring on my guest, and he's with me here in the studio. I'm very happy about that. I've got Mark DeVries, and he produced and directed the award-winning 2013 documentary Speciesism, the movie, which screened at theaters worldwide and has been featured in Scientific American, The Huffington Post, CNN Headline News, Psychology Today, and most popularly, the Sydney Morning Herald, among many others. DeVries filmed the world's first aerial drone footage of factory farms, released as part of his 2014 Factory Farm Drone Project. DeVries continues to appear and speak at special screenings of Speciesism while working on several new projects. He currently lives in New York City, and that's why we're lucky to have him here in the studio. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks very much for having me here.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So let's talk first about your movie, Speciesism. That's fun to say.
Right. It took me a while to figure out what was the right way to say it, but yeah, it's Speciesism.
Yeah, it's that S in the middle that,
right,
that kind of throws me. Speciesism.
Right.
What is speciesism, while we're on the subject?
Well, some philosophers and scientists starting in the 1970s began to argue that our unthinking assumption that humans are more important ethically than non-human animals, that there's a justification for a sharp ethical distinction that we make between humans and non-human animals, they argue is a form of prejudice, similar to prejudices against groups of humans, like racism and sexism. So to analogize with that, they popularized the term speciesism. And these philosophers and scientists and lawyers have been arguing that if we can't find a philosophical and ethical justification for this sharp distinction that we draw between humans and non-human animals in terms of how much we matter ethically, they argue that the way in which we treat animals, for example, billions of animals on factory farms, may be one of the most serious ethical issues of our time.
I remember when I first heard about it, it was a long time ago, and it was when I heard Gary Francione speak at a Summerfest event, and he was the first one who said racism, homophobism, sexism, speciesism all together, but I don't think he originated that whole phrase, but that's where I first heard it, and it was one of these, pow, whoa, I get it.
Right. I think that one of the reason I named the film Speciesism, the movie, and the reason I speak about that in the film is because it really has an impact to think about how one's own assumptions may be a form of prejudice. We all think about how other people and much of society in the past, and obviously to a large extent, often still in the present, harbor all kinds of prejudices that we like to assume we don't have. You know, we like to say, well, we're not racist and we're not sexist and so forth. And the term speciesism is a wake-up call to get us to think about, why do we assume that non-human animals, members of other species, that their well-being is significantly less important than our own? Because the evidence is very strong that they're capable of suffering physically and emotionally, probably to the very same level of intensity as human beings. So why is it that we should think that their suffering is significantly less important than ours? That's a really significant question.
There were a number of moments in your film when you posed questions like that to people, and you could really see how it just didn't process with them because of their understanding and prejudices and cultural biases, whatever. It just doesn't compute.
It takes a while. Absolutely. I think when you first hear it, it's just sort of where our habits in terms of our behavior and in terms of our thinking are ingrained from when we're very young to view non-human animals as completely distinct ethically. And so when you first come across it, it sometimes is just sort of a shock, the idea, or just doesn't make sense. And it takes a while, which is why I sort of repeat it in different ways and show different ways of expressing the idea in the film, because it really takes that to try to break down years, often decades, of the development of this view of ourselves and non-human animals.
Well, for some people, they don't ever want to make the acknowledgement because it would go against everything they've ever believed and who they are, and it takes a lot of courage. I think it's easier sometimes for younger people to make the change because they don't have as much invested in their own ethics and morality and philosophy, and it's harder for older people.
Right, absolutely. That seems to be the case. One phrase that I've heard is that change happens funeral by funeral in terms of that, as new generations come in, those are the people rather than the people alive today. Who are the ones who are more likely to make a change, and then the generation following that even more likely, and so forth, with most of the changes in society's perceptions.
Now, you appear in this film, Speciesism, the movie, as if you are learning along the way. And is that what's really happening, or that's just part of the story?
No, I actually was not as familiar with the issue when I started out as I was by the end of the film. When I first came across the issue, it was just I came across some demonstrations, like it shows in the film, some protests by some organizations like PETA, and I became curious about what was behind all of that. So I did some initial research on factory farming and on the issue of animal rights and so forth. But it was actually during the film that I really was able to make the intellectual and emotional switch in my perception of non-human animals.
Now, how did the film change you? Has it changed the way you eat?
Oh, yeah. I was not vegan when I started making the film, and I was vegan by the time I finished it.
Now, I only watched the film once, and I don't remember you using the word vegan or vegetarian. Now, did I miss something, or was that intentional?
No, it is in there, but I don't stress it from the beginning, because I think a lot of people who are not already vegetarian or vegan, it's sort of distracting to start talking about that question from the beginning, because the deeper underlying question is about whether or not we can justify our views of non-human animals, and how, of course, the evidence and arguments seem to suggest that we can't. And then the conclusions about the questions of whether or not we should go vegetarian or vegan follow a little bit later on.
Okay, so there were a number of different moments in the film, and I really recommend watching this film. It's 90 minutes. It's, right, an hour and a half, pretty much?
94 minutes, yeah.
And it's $1.99, which in my book is free, which is, I was trying to figure out what that's relative to, so I was thinking it's less than a day using my cell phone, $1.99, because my cell phone plan is more than that, unfortunately. And it's less than, or pretty close to, the price of a Venti hot tea with soy milk at Starbucks.
Probably less.
So it's very reasonable and worth watching, especially watching with someone who really isn't as familiar with what's going on or seems to think they are. It's a film that, for people that don't really want to see what's really going on in the factories, the horrible parts, you don't really see that. So people don't have to be afraid that there's going to be that horrible footage. It's really just talking about some very fundamental concepts about species and the ability to feel pain and suffering and what we are contributing to by our own actions.
And the website is speciesismthemovie.com.
Speciesismthemovie.com.
So speciesism is the word species, like a species of animal, and then ism, just like racism or sexism.
Yeah, so you really should check that out. Now, so a couple of moments for me. There was the couple that had a chicken farm that you tried to get on. There was a woman.
Right.
And she didn't want you on the farm. She didn't want you to see anything. And that tells me so much right away. When somebody is afraid or reluctant to show you what's going on, everything should be transparent.
Right. I mean, if they're reluctant to show you what's going on, and I even said, look, we can give you the camera and you can go in. We don't even have to go in there. And of course, they were unwilling to do it. This was a rare example of, unlike the usual contract farmers, where people are contractors raising birds, for example, for a large corporation, this was one independent farm. So I was actually able to speak with the owners, whom you see in the film. That was one of the co-owners of this husband and wife team. And it was 800,000 birds, 800,000 in this egg farm. As described in the film, it smelled horrific just being nearby. And they were completely unwilling even to, as I said, let me give them the camera so they could go in and film what was going inside to show that, to show what they claimed was nothing problematic. I said, well, here, why don't you prove it?
That's the part of humanity that I find really hard to understand. They knew what they were doing, and they knew it was something people didn't want to see.
Right.
And how do they do that?
Right.
But they do, and a lot of people do it. And by buying their products, you are part of the problem.
Right. And by changing your consumer choices, you're part of the solution, which is...
Oh, I like that. That's positive.
I mean, it really is true that each one of us has real power in the choices that we make and the consumer choices. That's what drives the industry to make improvements and so forth.
Yeah. If the customer wasn't there, the product wouldn't be there. In most cases.
Right.
There are companies that are making products that they're going to teach us that we need to use. But we really need to be mindful about everything that we use, everything we do, and everything we purchase, I think. Another favorite moment was when you went to the Simon Wiesenthal Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget exactly who, the man you were speaking to.
It was one of the directors.
One of the directors. Okay. So... this man did not want to hear anything that you had to say. He was pretending to be polite, but there was this big wall around him.
Right. I think...
And you could see how wrong he was.
Right. I think it was very obvious, and that's why that particular scene is so interesting, I think, because it was very obvious based upon the conversation that you see there. And that's actually probably the only part of the film that has a fairly extended single clip where he's asked to justify his position. And he, you know, after several attempts to change the subject or move on to other things, he admits, "I don't know." And that was, I think, very telling, especially for someone who has thought about this, that when you really do think about these questions that we assume usually have an easy answer, that humans are more important for some reason or another, once you start really thinking about it in a deeper way, things fall apart and our view of animals seems like it's required to change.
Now, did he know that you made a film out of that interview?
I haven't spoken with him since the film.
Okay. And did he know that was part of the plan, that you wanted to make a documentary?
Oh, yeah.
And he agreed to that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then afterwards, it was over and he forgot about it.
I think probably, yeah.
Yeah. Too bad. Interesting. I mean, people just don't even realize what they're saying.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to see in the case of... Our view of animals, it's often very funny, and that's why I show the often funny scenes of me speaking with people on the street, asking mm-hmm. them how they justify the view that humans are more important than animals.
They can't.
And it one of the consequences is it's actually pretty funny to see how it is that we do these mental gymnastics trying to justify something that seems so obvious, but on some brief reflection seems very difficult to justify.
Yeah, you kept bringing up the subject of pain and how these animals feel pain. We know it. And how are we capable of allowing them to continue to feel pain, and comparing it with the Holocaust and how, you know, many people say, oh, you can't do that. Yeah, you can do it. Because it's just another part of humanity, that something that we've done that's wrong. And people go along with it, and it has to stop. It's just wrong. Now, just two more things, and then we'll move on to some new stuff. But I appreciated you including your father in the film and his own journey with pain. That was very powerful.
I think that is often many people's favorite part of the film in terms of what they find most powerful. That my father, as a result of an injury, suffers from severe chronic pain. And pointing out that non-human animals, like, for example, birds who are used for food, who are bred to grow so big, so fast that they're their bodies are collapsing, that the evidence suggests very strongly that they feel severe, intense physical pain. And if physical pain is as strong in non-human animals as it is in humans, which is what the evidence points to, speaking with a person who suffers severe pain really helps us realize just how serious this is. Because even though these animals can't talk, here's a person experiencing basically more or less the same type of thing who can describe it. So in a sense, he's describing it for the animals. And that's something I don't think had ever been done before in a documentary or I suppose anywhere. So that really has an impact on audiences.
Something that surprises me is there are journalists and other people who have researched factory farming. Some of them have put out movies or have created organizations, written books. One of my favorite is David Kirby's book, Animal Factory, and he's a best-selling author. And I had him on this program, and very bright. And his story is more about the human perspective, how factory farming negatively affects humans, and it's pretty awful in terms of the environmental degradation that and the businesses that go out of business when factory farms come into a town and all the pollution, and it's just horrible. But it didn't cause him to change the way he eats in terms of eliminating animal products from his diet. He cares about sustainable agriculture, and we can all define that any way we want to, humane production of animals. I don't know how you could dig into a subject like this and not come to the conclusion, I am not going to participate in this.
I think a big part of it is that we are all so ingrained in the habits of eating animals, and everyone around us does it, and we see it as just part of the way things are, that we don't even think it's something that makes sense to question. To say, well, wait a second, why don't we just not eat animals? Why are we raising and killing all of these animals to eat their corpses when we just don't have to do that? And that is something that has only relatively recently started to be discussed on a broader scale in our society, and that's why we're seeing the beginnings of real changes in terms of the number of animals being raised for food going down quite dramatically for the first time since the dawn of factory farming.
Right. I think well, in this country, numbers are going down, and unfortunately, in China and India, they're going up.
Right.
And they don't want to learn from our mistakes. Who would want to?
Right.
And they're getting diabetes and all kinds of health issues as a result. It's just a disaster. Another book I wanted to mention was Stephen Wise's American Trilogy, The Death, Slavery, and Dominion on the Banks of the Cape Fear River. And he talks about, he connects the dots between how we had slavery in North Carolina with African Americans, and how that kind of morphed into how we treat animals in factory farms. And there's a lot, I think more pigs are slaughtered in North Carolina in this country than anywhere. And there's so much pollution. I think you showed some of it, and maybe your factory farm drone project is going to go there too. Let's get into that. But I just wanted to mention, sort of changing the subject, but Steve Wise has got a number of court cases here in New York where he's trying to get habeas corpus. He's trying to get these animals recognized as sentient beings so that they don't have to be imprisoned and allow a few chimps to go to sanctuaries. And The wonderful news is in Argentina, they actually approved this habeas corpus concept for an orangutan and freed this orangutan and allowed it to go to a sanctuary. This is new news. That's why I'm mentioning it. And just like connecting some dots here with something that Steve Wise is trying to do here in New York. It's interesting that Argentina is ahead of us in this liberty and freedom kind of game. But it's relatively good news.
And Stephen Wise actually says he was influenced to take on this topic after reading Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, which also is sort of the main his arguments are Peter Singer's arguments from Animal Liberation are one of the main points of discussion in the film. And of course, I speak with Peter Singer in some in some detail in the film. And that's also what popularized the term speciesism.
So one thing that's frustrating to me, I know that change takes a long time, but I want it now. I want everybody to be happy and not to suffer and not have pain. Okay.
Right.
But so I started on this path a long time ago, like, I'm just trying to do the math, 40 years ago, let's say, and learned a little bit here and there by a book and a magazine. We didn't have the internet when I got started. And yet it's still mind-boggling to me because I talk about this stuff every day to a lot of people who talk about this stuff every day. And yet there's still so many people who don't know. And that's why, you know, we need people like you, Mark DeVries, creating new works that people can be exposed to. We need to be, like, slamming people with this information day in and day out.
I think it is entering into the mainstream discussion more so just in the past decade than it ever has before. I mean, this is, you know, we see it now for the first time really being discussed in major newspapers and magazines and so forth. So I think we have every reason to be optimistic in terms of the discussion really developing and also in terms of more and more people actually changing their own consumer choices and their own diets.
As this concept gets more and more known, we have lots of different factions appearing. So it's not just being vegan or not eating animals. There's people approaching it from different angles about how we move forward and how we make change. And I've been talking a lot about it on this program, how polarized we've become. You have a number of people in your movie Speciesism, Bruce Friedrich and Nathan Runkel from Mercy for Animals. Bruce Friedrich was with PETA at the time. Now he's with Farm Sanctuary. And I'm trying to think of some other people. You also had Gary Francione. And those Gary is diametrically opposed to the activities that people like Bruce Friedrich and Nathan Runkel are doing, where they have this step-by-step making improvements for animals any way we can get them versus just the opposite opinion is let's just focus on making it all go away. And do you fit in somewhere in that continuum?
That's such a complex issue that I don't really take a strong view on it, at least not currently. But interestingly, I filmed a debate, a really good, interesting debate between Bruce Friedrich and Gary Francione, who are, of course, both like major proponents of two very different views there. And you can see it on YouTube if you type in Bruce Friedrich, Gary Francione debate or
that.
Something like that. And that really hashes out a lot of the major issues.
Yeah, down deep within me, I want to side with Gary Francione because I just think all of this stuff is wrong and it needs to go away. There's a realist in me that says, well, that's just not going to happen and we need to make improvements any way we possibly can.
Right. I mean, interestingly, of course, people who are in favor of reforms, for example, like Bruce Friedrich, are obviously also vegan and also in favor of abolishing the use of non-human animals and people being vegan and so forth, abolishing their use for food and so forth. But they argue, of course, that the if we're thinking about how to reduce the most suffering, considering the amount of suffering that's going on with billions of non-human animals on factory farms every year, the things we can do in terms of reforms, they argue, can reduce significant amounts of suffering that make a difference to significant numbers of animals that are not going to be affected anytime soon in terms of if we're looking at the number of people going vegetarian and vegan. So there are all kinds of, you know, interesting, quite detailed, both philosophical and empirical discussions.
Yeah. Now, the last thing I want to talk about your film before we move on to the next big subject, Speciesism, the movie, there was a moment where one of your team was talking about his epiphany, and he's driving in the car and basically talking about this frustration that a lot of us have. You know, what do we do? What can we do? What we want to do is, like, scream at everyone when you realize what's going on and you want to say, this can't happen anymore. You want to shake everybody. Come on, don't you get it? But you can't do that.
Right. I think most people, or probably most people, go through some period where they first really learn about what happens to animals, and when it first clicks that it's this serious ethically, they look around and the world looks so different and people look bad. And it is important to remember both that people, rather than being bad, are ingrained in their habits and in their thinking, and also that things are, despite these ingrained habits, really changing in terms of, as we mentioned, the number of animals raised for food going down, the public discussion about what happens to animals going up, and it's something that takes place over generations, and the best way to take part in that and help things continue moving forward is to be understanding and have empathy for people who don't understand yet and haven't made changes in their thinking and in their choices. And one of the things that I always find useful is when someone asks you, for example, why are you vegetarian or why are you vegan, instead of, as many people are in the habit of doing, and that I was in the habit of doing, sort of telling them why. Well, because this is what happens to animals and this is what happens to the environment and so forth. Letting them into your thought process. So saying things like, oh, well, someone asked why you're vegetarian or why are you vegan. Well, I came across this stuff recently about factory farming. And I learned X, Y, Z. And the more I think about it, the more it seems like I can't really justify supporting this. So at least tentatively, it seems like I ought not to support this. And what do you think? And making it a discussion where you and the person you're speaking with are both looking at the issues and questions together makes it something that's not combative and that opens people's minds to thinking about it. I think that really makes all the difference.
It's a good approach, a very good approach. You don't want to be combative. You don't want to put people on the defensive. There are still going to be a lot of people that just say, oh, I can't give up my whatever.
Right. Although, you know, as more and more people become vegetarian and more vegetarian and vegan options become available. So a lot of the people who wouldn't have been willing to make the change now would be willing to make the change, people in that same sort of level of willingness to make the change, as it becomes more convenient, are more willing to make the change in the future, just like a lot of people who become vegetarian and vegan now wouldn't have been willing to do it maybe a decade or so ago.
Yeah, we're more followers than we are leaders, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So we just need to tip the scale enough to get everybody following. Mm-hmm. Very good. Let's take a little break, and then I want to talk about your factory farm drone project. Very exciting. Okay, we'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back on December 30th, 2014, for another part of It's All About Food. And I'm here in the studio with Mark DeVries, who is the creator of Speciesism, the movie. And we're going to be talking more about factory farming. That's what it's all about. But I just want to remind you, you can send me comments and questions to my email, info@realmeals.org. And I love to hear from you. You know that. So, factoryfarmdrone.com, is that where we go?
Factoryfarmdrones.com.
Well, right. Okay. Now, drones are an interesting thing. I'm not exactly sure when they first came into use, but more people are using them in creative ways. Do we just go to, like, Home Depot and pick one up? How do we get a drone?
Well, there are different types of drones that have different capabilities. So there are consumer drones
that you can fly around that will just that you can attach certain types of small cameras to. The ones I used were a little bit more sophisticated in that I was able to set a GPS to have it go to specific locations and set an altitude hold so that it would hover at a certain altitude so that I could take footage of specific places at exact known locations at certain altitudes and then bring the drone back to where I was and so forth. And that really allows it allowed me to get a lot of, as I can talk about, and as you can see at factoryfarmdrones.com, the really dramatic images of how these massive pig factory farms function. It was I knew about it, and I had seen it from my movie Speciesism, the movie, from an airplane from a few thousand feet, but there wasn't any footage from an aerial shot up close. And even knowing what to expect in the abstract, I was just shocked when the footage came back.
When you see these giant lagoons filled with piss and poop.
Right. I mean, there are thousands upon thousands of pigs in each facility, generally, and they live in crowded pens over concrete slatted floors.
And you can't see them.
Right. They're inside of these buildings, these huge warehouse-looking buildings. And the waste falls through the slats in the floors and is flushed through the slats in the floors, like using hoses and so forth, into giant open-air cesspools, just out in the open, often the size of several football fields in area, just filled with toxic animal manure. And from thousands and thousands of animals making millions of gallons of waste, and pig waste is actually similar to human waste. So it would be in many ways similar to having a gigantic lake of untreated human sewage just out in the open.
Yeah.
And in North Carolina, there are literally thousands of these. So I went to several different facilities for the Factory Farm Drones project and documented these open-air cesspools, and also from the ground documented how they get rid of the contents of the cesspool, which is almost too unbelievable to think really happens. It's sprayed using gigantic versions of garden sprayers straight up into the air, where it often turns to a fine mist and then drifts to neighboring communities. And the public health impacts of these facilities have been documented and are very serious. There are increasing rates of upper respiratory ailments, spikes in people's blood pressure when the odorant chemicals are coming their way, increases in asthma rates among school children nearby. It's really...
What stuns me is that we can't do this with human waste. We have strict regulations for human waste. You can't pee on a sidewalk, okay? You could get arrested. And yet we are allowed to have these open-air giant cesspools, these poop pools, urine pools. And there are a handful of regulations for them. And even when they are not followed, a lot of the factory farms don't don't pay the fines. It's just sick, 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 and we allow it to happen. Every bite into a hamburger, every piece of bacon, every time you consume an animal product, you're contributing to this. It's like a tacit agreement.
Right, and that's also how to change things, to be reducing or eliminating your purchase of these products is what causes fewer animals to be raised in these facilities and reduces the environmental devastation. That is what has an impact. As long as people are continuing to buy the products, this will continue happening.
Now, are we allowed to do this?
Well, interestingly, it seems like the current laws that are so different between human waste and farm waste are perhaps a relic of the time when farms didn't house thousands and thousands of animals. Mm-hmm. So farm waste was not that big of a problem. It was applied as fertilizer, for example, and it was manageable. And now, of course, with thousands upon thousands of animals indoors in these buildings and it being flushed into these cesspools, it's basically like having a small or medium-sized city with all of the sewage just being dumped into a lake.
And what about the drones? Are there rules on how we can use them and not use them?
Yeah, there are regulations such as that the drones should be kept below 400 feet so that they don't have any chance of interfering with airplanes, which obviously are much, much higher than 400 feet, but just to be safe, for example, things like that. And I think as drones become more commonly used, both for investigative reporting and for people just playing with the smaller consumer versions, we'll see more regulations that sort of hash out how we can compromise between the use of drones and making sure that they're not a danger, for example, to aviation, like making sure
right.
they're
so
not.
So now you need to get as much footage as you possibly can before the rules get stricter against you, because I can imagine any of these CAFOs, these confined animal factory organizations and these factory farms, they're going to fight to get people not to do this. They don't want anybody seeing anything that they're doing.
Right, exactly. And there are already places where, as a result of these laws called ag gag laws, it is illegal to film factory farms. And in some ways, it might be beneficial still to get footage from those states, precisely because being prosecuted under an ag gag law might just get even more public attention to what it is that you're documenting.
Yep. Telling it like it is, which isn't very good. Okay, so is there something that new that we get from this kind of footage other than being stunned at seeing this big pool of poop close up?
I think first, of course, it definitely is quite different close up in terms of getting an idea of the scale of it and being able to see, for example, the pipes that drain from the facilities into these lagoons and so forth, and how close they are to people's homes, how close the spray fields that spray the manure in the air are to neighborhoods. But also, in the future, drones might be able to be used to keep an eye out for specific infractions, for example, dumping waste directly into rivers or streams, mm-hmm. that a wider use of drones to keep an eye on these factory farms might help keep them more accountable in terms of largely water pollution.
So what future plans do you have with your drones, or are you allowed to say? Are they secret?
Well, I can't give too many specific details, mm-hmm. but I think that drones, mine included, will be able to continue filming different aspects of factory farming.
I imagine they work okay in bad weather?
They do. Of course, it depends on the drone, and it depends on how bad the weather is in terms of whether it's rain or high winds. The drones that I used are designed to operate in rain and are designed to using GPS stabilization when they're blown off course to automatically come back to their course or their location.
I remember when I was reading David Kirby's book, Animal Factory, it seemed like the worst things that happen with those lagoons were during bad weather situations.
Exactly. I was just going to say that often in terms of the lagoons overflowing when there's sudden rain, and then that, of course, going right into groundwater and into rivers or streams, which is quite disastrous. And also, before the rain, in order to prevent that, the farms often apparently do a lot more spraying in the air than they would to make sure the lagoon level stays at a certain amount. So either way, whether it floods or whether it doesn't, the consequences are bad.
It's just so disgusting. It's so... I just can't believe what humans will invent. It took a scientist. It took an engineer. It took someone who had a college degree or several to invent these things and then have companies want to support them and build them so you could spray poop into the air.
Right.
Oh, goodness. All right. All right. Can I ask you what kind of equipment you use when you're filming?
In terms of the drone equipment or other camera
Just for
equipment?
Camera equipment.
For the first film, I used an SD camera, actually, a Panasonic DVX, which works very well in terms of bringing it around and to a lot of places very quickly. It's a very sturdy camera and so forth. So when I was doing things like crawling through the bushes to get to the spray fields and pulling it out really fast to talk to these factory farmers, I was able to do that successfully with this particular type of camera. And the camera that I'm going to be using is a high-definition, similar version of that same type of camera. They're relatively small. Maybe they're not really small, but they're not the kind that's so big it has to be on
your
shoulder. Yeah.
I was just wondering, because there were a number of times in your movies where the people didn't want the camera on, and yet somehow they remained on. So how did they not notice unless...
Well, that was one of the camera operators.
That was tricky.
Right. That was one of the camera operators, Alana, who did a very good job sort of innocently looking like she wasn't paying attention anymore while still holding the camera. One time she actually unplugged her headphones and showed them the socket of the headphones and said, "Oh, it's unplugged," as if that was relevant to it not filming.
Very clever. Very clever indeed. Yeah. It's amazing what we can do today, and it's a good thing that we have these cameras and we have this technology and we have the internet so that we can share all of this information. Because unfortunately, if people can get away with things, they will.
Right. And I think that's the role of documentary film and investigative reporting.
Right. Okay. Let's see. So anything else you want to add about factory farm droning that we need to know about?
Well, I think that in addition to just the footage from the drones, which is really dramatic, it makes a big difference to hear from the neighbors who've been affected by these facilities. Mm-hmm. And I do that in the first film, Speciesism, the movie, and in the factory farm drone project. And people describe not being able to open their windows when the wind is coming their way. One person actually described the spray fields being so close that it actually sprays onto her house, where she can walk outside, and as she says in the video, it's like it's raining. It's just the impacts on these neighbors, and that the fact that it's not a bigger national outrage is actually quite surprising to me. And I think it might have something to do with the fact that people still perceive of farms as being inherently not that bad. If these were chemical plants or something else like that, and they were having these impact on people, people might say, people might be quicker to realize something is seriously wrong, whereas we still assume that farms are not factories. But these are factories, and this is just like having factory pollution.
Well, if you look and see where many of these factories are, they typically come into poor communities where people are not empowered and they don't have the ability to make change, and they do that intentionally. And they even convince the local governments that they're going to improve the economy. They make some promises, and they're going to bring in more jobs. And I remember reading in that book, Animal Factory, that it never happened, that they brought people in typically from other places and didn't hire the people from within. And even if they did, they're low-paying.
There are a relatively small number of low-paying jobs that don't offer an opportunity for advancement because it's really, you know, centralized, vertically integrated companies where they're just looking to hire people for, like, specific hourly positions that aren't going to change. So it's not going to increase people's quality of life when those farms come in and replace other kinds of places. And also it can reduce the property values. So these farms move in near people's homes, and then the people can't move out because they can't afford to sell their home, which they won't get any money for, and buy a home somewhere else. So they're literally stuck. They're prisoners to these massive open-air cesspools that have now appeared next to their – outside their backyards.
So our craving, our desire for animal flesh not only horribly affects animals, but it affects all of us, the people that live near these factories that have this horrible smell that's affecting the health of their children especially and themselves. It pollutes the water. It's just a disaster. And then we have something new, something in the news all the time, foodborne illnesses. You may have heard just this week about caramel apples and how there's listeria in these caramel apples and how you shouldn't be purchasing packaged caramel apples. Well, you know, most of this type of problem in our food is caused by all this poop that gets out into the environment. Some of it actually is used as fertilizer on fruit and vegetable fields, and it just gets out of whack and contaminates everything.
And on top of that, the use of antibiotics is very serious and very troubling. In order to prevent them from getting ill when they're in these stressful, tightly confined conditions, and also to increase their growth rate, often animals are on factory farms fed what are called low-level antibiotics, like a consistent low amount of antibiotics in their feed that adds up and then, of course, ends up in water supply and so forth, and can result in antibiotic-resistant bacteria that will prevent us from treating human ailments when bacteria become resistant to the antibiotics that we're using. So it's creating a serious public health threat that's looming.
Looming. Okay, so we have 2 minutes, and I want to just sum up a few things and make a few recommendations. So we've got the new year coming. People want to make resolutions. A great resolution would be go vegan or at least eat fewer animals. And let's put these factory farms out of business. It's up to each and every one of us. And maybe New Year's Eve, you don't have any plans. You can invite some people over and watch Speciesism, the movie, right? And then if you think, I don't know how I could give up whatever your favorite foods that might be that are animal-based, we can help you. We have so many recipes at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. There are so many vegan cookbooks out there. There are so many free recipes you can get online. And if you have like a particular little something you think you cannot get over and you need help, just send me an email, info@realmeals.org. If I can't help you, I'll find somebody who can. We are out there to make this world a better place.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. And I can't make a better recommendation than what you just did. It's much easier than it ever has been to replace what you eat with vegan foods.
The food's fabulous. You're going to look better. You're going to feel sexier. Here's to a plant positive, powerful 2015. Okay, and remember, have a delicious week. Okay, and a delicious year. Bye-bye.